Bartimaeus, Chapter 27. Evening was drawing closer. The proprietors of the smaller coffee-houses in the back streets around the square were stirring themselves at last, lighting lamps that hung from door-beams and stacking up the wooden chairs that had spilled out across the pavements through the day. A peal of eventide bells was being tolled beneath the dark black spires of Old Tyne Church, where my good friend Tycho lies entombed, and the streets murmured with Prague's people walking home. Tycho Brahe, 1546-1601. Magician, astronomer, and duelist. Perhaps the least offensive of my masters. Well, in fact, quite possibly the most offensive, if he were one of his human contemporaries, since Tycho was a passionate fellow, forever getting into fights and trying to kiss friends' wives. That was how he lost his nose, incidentally. It was cut off by a lucky stroke during a duel over a woman. I fashioned him a fine gold replacement, together with a delicate tufted stick for burnishing the nostrils, and with this won his friendship. Thereafter he summoned me mainly when he fancied a good conversation. For much of the day the boy had sat slumped at a white-clothed table outside a tavern, reading a succession of Czech newspapers and cheap pamphlets. If he looked up, he had a good view of the old town square, into which the street opened a dozen metres away. If he looked down, he had an even better view of a medley of empty coffee cups and dishes strewn with sausage scraps and pretzel crumbs, the relics of his afternoon's consumption. I was sitting at the same table, wearing a large pair of dark glasses and a swanky coat similar to his. For token effect, I had placed a pretzel on my plate and broken it into a few pieces, to make it look like I was trying. But of course I ate and drank nothing. Mortal food clogs our essence, something chronic. If we do devour anything, such as a human, say, it generally has to be still alive, so that its living essence galvanizes our own. This outweighs the burden of ingesting the useless bone and flesh. Sorry, not putting you off your tea, am I? The old town square was one of the largest open areas in the east of the city, an uneven space of bright cobbles, spotted with pedestrians and flower stalls. Flocks of birds drifted lazily down in front of the elegant five-story houses. Smoke rose from a thousand chimneys. It was as peaceful a scene as could be wished for. Yet I was not at ease. "Will you stop fidgeting?" The boy slapped his pamphlet on the table. "I can't concentrate." "Can't help it," I said. "We're too exposed here."
"Relax. We're in no danger."
I looked around furtively. "So you say. We should have stayed in the hotel." The boy shook his head.
"I'd have gone mad if I'd stayed in that flea-pit a moment longer. I couldn't sleep in that bed for dust. And a tribe of bed-bugs were feasting on me all night. I heard them popping off me every time I sneezed."
"If you were dusty, you should have had a bath." He looked embarrassed.
"Didn't fancy that tub, somehow. It was a bit too hungry-looking. Anyhow, Prague's safe enough. There's hardly any magic here any more. You've seen nothing all the time we've been sitting here. No imp, no jinni, no spell. And we're in the centre of town. No one's likely to see you for what you are. Relax!"
I shrugged. "If you say so. It won't be me running round the walls with soldiers jabbing pikes into my trousers." He wasn't listening. He'd picked up his pamphlet again and was frowning his way through it. I returned to my afternoon's occupation, namely checking and double-checking the planes. Here's the thing. The boy was absolutely right. We'd seen nothing magical all day. This was not to say the authorities weren't represented. A few soldiers in dark blue uniforms with shiny jackboots and highly burnished caps had wandered repeatedly through the square. Once they had stopped at my master's table and asked for our identification. My master produced his fake ID while I performed a glaze upon them, so they forgot the object of their query and wandered on. As a rough rule of thumb, the jazzier the uniform, the less powerful the army. In its golden age, Prague's soldiers wore sober outfits with little decoration. Now, to my disgust, they minced about under a heavyweight of pompous finery. A fluffy epaulette here, an extra brass knobble there. You could hear their metal bits jingling like bells on cats' collars from far off down the street. Contrast that with London's night police. Their outfits were the colour of river sludge, yet they were the ones to fear. But we'd seen none of the magical sorties that were par for the course in London—search spheres, foliots masquerading as pigeons, etc. It all seemed very innocent. Yet, having said that, I could feel strong magic somewhere in the vicinity, not far from where we were, operating vigorously on all the planes. Each one tingled with it, particularly the seventh, which is usually where the most trouble comes. It wasn't aimed at us, yet. Even so, it made me nervous, particularly because the boy, being human, young, and arrogant, sensed nothing and persisted in acting like a tourist. I didn't like being in the open. "We should have agreed to meet him in a lonely spot," I persisted. "This is just too public." The boy snorted. "And give him the opportunity to come dressed as a ghoul again? I think not. He can wear a suit and tie like everyone else." 6 o'clock drew near. The boy paid our bill and stuffed pamphlets and newspapers hurriedly into his rucksack. "A hot dog stand it is, then," he said. "As before, hang back and protect me if anything happens." "Okay, boss. You're not wearing a red feather this time. How about a rose or a ribbon in your hair?"
"No, thank you."
"Just asking." We parted in the crowd. I peeled off, keeping close to the buildings on one side, while the boy continued on out into the center of the square. Since most of the homegoers, for one reason or another, kept to the edges, this made him look slightly isolated. I watched him go. A flock of sparrows erupted from the cobbles near his feet and flapped away towards the rooftops high above. I scanned them anxiously, but there were no hidden watchers among them. All was well, for now. A gentleman with a small struggling moustache and an enterprising nature had affixed a wheeled brazier to a bicycle and had cycled to a vantage point near the middle of the square. Here he had set his coals alight and was busily toasting spiced sausages for the hungry citizens of Prague. A small queue had formed, and to this my master attached himself, glancing casually around for the appearance of Harlequin. I positioned myself nonchalantly by one of the perimeter walls and surveyed the square. I didn't like it. Too many windows ablaze with the light of the dying sun. It was impossible to tell who might be looking down from them. 6 o'clock came and went. Harlequin did not appear. The sausage queue shortened. Nathaniel was last in line. He shuffled forwards, fumbling in his pocket for some change. I checked out the passers-by in all the distant fringes of the square. A small knot stood gossiping below the town hall, but most people were still hurrying homewards, entering and departing down the roads that fed into the square. If Harlequin was anywhere close, he gave no sign. My feeling of unease grew. There was still no magic visible, but still that tingling sensation on every plane. Out of habit, I checked each exit road. There were seven. That at least was good. Plenty of avenues of escape, should the need arise. Nathaniel was now second in the queue. A small girl was ahead of him, demanding extra ketchup on her sausage. A tall man strode out across the square. He wore a suit and hat. He carried a battered satchel. I eyed him up. He seemed about the right height for Harlequin, though it was difficult to be sure. Nathaniel had not yet noticed him. He was watching the small girl stagger off under the weight of her vast hot dog. The man made for Nathaniel, walking fast. Too fast, perhaps. Almost as if he had some unseen purpose. I started forwards. The man passed close behind Nathaniel without giving him a glance. He marched away smartly over the cobbles. I relaxed again. Perhaps the boy was right. I was a little jittery. Now Nathaniel was purchasing his sausage. He appeared to be haggling with the vendor about the amount of extra sauerkraut. Where was Harlequin? The clock on the tower of the old town hall showed 6:12. He was very late. I heard a distant jingling somewhere amid the pedestrians on the edges of the square. Faint, rhythmic, like the bells on Lapland sleighs heard far off across the snow. It seemed to come from all sides at once. It was familiar to me, yet somehow different to anything I had heard before. I could not place it. Then I saw the specks of blue weaving their way through the bystanders at the entrance to every one of the seven streets, and understood. Boots slapped on cobblestones, sunlight glinted on rifles, metal paraphernalia jangled on the chests of half of Prague's armed forces as they shouldered their way into view. The crowd melted backwards, voices rising in alarm. The soldiers stopped suddenly. Solid lines blocked each street. I was already running out across the square.
"Mandrake," I shouted. "Forget Harlequin. We have to go."
The boy turned, holding his hot dog. He noticed the soldiers for the first time.
"Ah," he said. "Tiresome."
"Too right it is. And we can't go over the roofs, either. We're badly outnumbered there, too."
Nathaniel looked up, treating himself to a grandstand view of several dozen foliots, which had evidently scrabbled up the roofs on the far side, and were now crouching on the uppermost tiles and chimneys of every house in the square, leering down at us and making offensive gestures with their tails. The hot dog seller had seen the army cordons. With a yelp of fright, he leapt onto the saddle of his bicycle and veered furiously away across the cobbles, leaving a trail of sausages, sauerkraut, and hissing red-hot coals behind him.
"They're only human," Nathaniel said. "This isn't London, is it? Let's break our way through them."
We were running now, towards the nearest street, Karlova.
"I thought you didn't want me to use any violence or obvious magic," I said.
"Those niceties are past. If our Czech friends want to start something, we can—"
"Oh!"
We still had the cyclist in view when it happened. As if crazed with fear, uncertain what to do, he had made two random sorties back and forth across the square. Suddenly, head down, feet pumping, he changed tack, charging straight at one of the army lines. One soldier raised a rifle. A shot rang out. The cyclist gave a twitch, his head slumped to one side, his feet slipped from the pedals and jerked and juddered against the ground. Still carried by its own momentum, the bicycle continued forwards at a great pace, brazier crashing and banging behind it, until it ploughed straight into the breaking line of soldiers and overturned, spilling body, sausages, hot coals, and cold cabbage over the nearest men. My master halted, panting hard.
"I need a shield," he said. "Now!"
"As you wish." I raised a finger, willed the shield around us both. It hung there shimmering, visible on the second plane. An uneven, potato-shaped orb that shifted when we moved.
"Now," the boy said savagely, "a detonation. We blast our way through."
I looked at him. "Are you sure about that? These men aren't djinn."
"Well, just knock them aside somehow. Bruise them gently. I don't care. As long as we get through unscathed."
A soldier disentangled himself from the mess of sprawling limbs and took swift aim. A shot. A bullet whistled across the 30-meter space. Straight through the shield and out again, parting Nathaniel's hair on the crown of his head en route. The boy glared at me.
"And what sort of shield do you call this?"
I made a face.
"They're using silver bullets."
Just as silver is deeply poisonous to our essence, so it is capable of cutting through many of our magical defences, like a hot knife through butter. Low in magic though Prague had now become, it seemed they hadn't forgotten all the old tricks. Not that silver bullets were mainly used on gin in the old days. They were generally employed against a hairier enemy.
"The shield's not safe. Come on!"
I turned, reached out for the scruff of his neck, and in the same movement made a necessary change. The slim, elegant form of Ptolemy grew and roughened, skin turned to stonework, dark hair to green lichen. All across the square, the soldiers had a fine view of a swarthy, bow-legged gargoyle stumping off at speed, dragging an angry adolescent beside him.
"Where are you going?" the boy protested. "We're cut off out here!"
The gargoyle gnashed its horny beak. "Quiet. I'm thinking." Which was hard enough to do in all that kerfuffle. I sprinted back into the centre of the square. From every street, soldiers were advancing slowly. Rifles at the ready, boots thudding, regalia rattling. Up on the roofs, the foliots chittered eagerly and began to stalk forwards. Down the steep inclines, claws on tiles clicking like the sound of a thousand insects. The gargoyle slowed and stopped. More bullets whizzed past us. Dangling as he was, the boy was vulnerable. I swung him up in front of me. Stone wings descended about him, blocking off the line of fire. This had the extra advantage of muffling his complaints. A silver bullet ricocheted off my wing, stinging my essence with its poisoned touch. We were surrounded on all sides. Silver at street level, foliots up high, which left only one option. The middle way. I retracted a wing briefly, held the boy up so he had a quick view of the square. "Take a look," I said. "Which house do you think has the thinnest walls?" For a moment he was uncomprehending. Then his eyes widened.
"You're not?" "That one, with the pink shutters? Yes, maybe you're right. Well, let's see."
And with that we were off, careering through a shower of bullets. Me, beak forward, eyes narrowed, him gasping, trying to curl up into a ball and shield his head with his arms all at once. On foot, gargoyles can put together a pretty fine turn of speed, provided we pump our wings as we run, and I'm pleased to say we left a thin, scorched trail on the stones behind us as we went. A brief description of my objective. A quaint four-story building, squared, broad, with tall arches at its base, marking out a shopping arcade. Behind it rose the bleak spires of Tyne Church. I could almost hear old Tycho urging me on. He'd loved to gamble, Tycho did. He once bet me my freedom that I couldn't jump across the Vultava in a single bound on a given day. If I succeeded, he was mine to do with as I wished. Of course, the cunning hound had calculated the date of the spring tides in advance. On the given day, the river burst its banks and flooded a much wider area than normal. I landed hooves first in the drink, much to my master's cruel amusement. He laughed so hard his nose fell off. The owner of this house loved it. Each window had twin shutters that had recently been repainted a delightful pink. Long, low window boxes sat on every sill, crammed to bursting with pink-white peonies. Frilly net curtains hung chastely across the inside of each window. It was all remarkably twee. The shutters didn't quite have hearts carved in their wood, but it was a close-run thing. Soldiers ran forwards from two side streets. They converged to cut us off. Foliot skittered off gutters and descended on looping parachutes of armskin. I thought on balance the second floor was the one to aim at, midway between our enemies. I ran, I jumped. My wings creaked and flapped. 2 tons of gargoyle launched proudly into the air. 2 bullets rose to meet us. Also a small Foliot, somewhat ahead of his fellows, descended into our path. The bullets shot by on either side. For his part, the Foliot was met by a stony fist, which concertinaed him into something round and flat, resembling an aggrieved pie-dish. 2 tons of gargoyle hit a window on the second floor. My shield was still in force. The boy and I were thus largely protected from the glass and timber, the bricks and plaster exploding all around us. This didn't stop him crying out in woe, which was more or less what the old lady sitting in her bath chair did as we flew past her at the topmost point of our arc. I had a brief glimpse of a genteel bedroom, in which ornamental lacework was given undue prominence. Then we were out of her life once more, exiting swiftly through the opposite wall. Down we fell, down into the cool shadows of a back street in a storm of bricks, through a tangle of washing that some thoughtless individual had hung on a line outside their window. We landed heavily, the gargoyle absorbing most of the impact in his hoary calves, the boy flung from his grasp and rolling off into the gutter. I got wearily to my feet. The boy did likewise. The outcry behind us was muffled now, but neither soldiers nor Foliots would be long in coming. A small street led away into the heart of the old town. Without a word, we took it. 30 minutes later, we were slumped in the shady overgrowth of an untended garden, catching our breath. No sounds of pursuit had been heard for many minutes. I had long since returned to Ptolemy's more unobtrusive form. "So," I said, "that not drawing attention to ourselves business. How are we doing?" The boy didn't answer. He was looking at something gripped tightly in his hands. "I suggest we forget Harlequin," I said. "If he's got any sense, he'll be emigrating to Bermuda after all this fuss. You'll never track him down again."
"I don't need to," my master said. "Besides, it wouldn't be any good. He's dead."
"Eh?" My famed eloquence had been sorely tested by events. It was at this point that I realized the boy was still holding his hot dog. It was looking a trifle forlorn after its adventure, the sauerkraut having been largely replaced by a scrummy coating of plaster, splinters of wood, broken glass and flower petals. The boy was staring at it intently.
"Look, I know you're hungry," I said, "but that's going a bit far. Let me find you a burger or something."
The boy shook his head. With dusty fingers he prized apart the bread.
"This," he said slowly, "is what Harlequin promised us. Our next contact in Prague."
"A sausage?"
"No, you fool! This!"
From underneath the hot dog he drew out a small piece of card, somewhat bent and ketchup-stained.
"Harlequin was the hot dog seller," he continued. "That was his disguise.
And now he's died for his country, so avenging him is part of our mission.
But first, this is the magician we must find."
He held out the card. Scrawled on it were just four words. Kavka, 13 Golden Lane.